So, do you think we should explain kind of what's going on this week and why the format's going to be a little bit different?
I think it'd be more fun to just let people guess.
Just be
Leave it
super
mysterious.
confusing.
No, honestly. So if we, the basically, I'm tired of talking true crime with you already. It's but
That's
three
fair.
episodes in.
And like
Just
every
kidding. Just
other day of
kidding.
our lives.
Just kidding. We are bringing on a guest host this week, a friend of ours, Katie, who
Yes.
we've known for years and someone that wanted to be a part of this conversation. So
Yes.
let's get into it.
Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
Hey everybody, welcome to Murder Unscripted, week three. So last week we talked in depth about the Bruce Blackwood case, which was a case that kind of became near and dear to me after producing an episode about it for Cold Case Files. And today we are so thrilled to have former detective Steve Phelan, NYPD 113th Precinct. He's joining us for a conversation. So here he is, Steve Phelan.
Yay.
Yay.
What is up, my brother?
Not much, my friend. How you doing?
Doing fine. You ever think we'd be doing something like this?
You know what, came a long way, and I never thought I'd be sitting at this desk talking about it.
It's pretty cool. It's a new era, and I think TV, I don't know what TV's doing, but that's why I'm in this boat. And I thought I'd make something out of it. So it's crazy to be talking to you in an element outside of the television production. I don't know.
Yeah, it's
But
cool.
yeah. So as you know, we are one of the reasons we're doing this show is to kind of show people the raw, unfiltered side of reality. Everybody sees this super polished TV show that we put together, and you see the people, you're wearing a suit, you're told what to say, you know, there's a way to say it. So I thought it would be cool to kind of talk to you as a human being. So this has nothing to do with TV. No one's going to tell you how to talk. So, I mean, there's so much more to what you do than just this TV star, which I'm sure your buddies give you plenty of shit for, right?
Yes, they do. It's all your fault.
It's like a fraternity, right? I mean, NYPD especially, you guys are brothers.
Yeah, I work with a lot of guys that I'm still friends with to this day. Guys that I started working with from 1987.
Wow.
That's what I'm hoping you. I wanted to start by talking a little bit about your career. I know that you had started because of your dad. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is.
So tell me about it. Talk to me about how you got when, like what year and what got you, what made you a cop?
Well, I had seven brothers and sisters, five brothers, two sisters. My oldest brother became a cop, and my father was a cop before him. And I didn't come on to NYPD till I was like 28 years old. I was terrible as a criminal from 28 to 20. So I
Man,
decided to switch sides.
good move.
I actually went into the police academy in 86. And I was able to get my father's shield. So
Wow.
between the three of us, we've actually carried the shield intermittently for like 44 years.
That's now, how did
Wow.
you? We talked about this the other day. Like, getting what's involved in getting a shield? Like, I never thought, like, there's like sports jerseys in Madison Square Garden, retired, they're done for. Like, but you can get them back, right?
The only time a shield number is not recirculated is, God forbid, a police officer dies in the line of duty. And that number gets retired and it'll stay retired. Every other number goes back into circulation.
Wow.
So I was lucky and fortunate to get it.
What did it mean to you to get it back?
Well, you should have seen my father's face when I showed it to him on the bar. I said, "Pop, we gotta take a look at this." And he was shocked. He really was.
Really?
Because it actually is the same shield. You have to turn in your old shield.
Oh,
And they know the difference.
wow.
They actually weigh it on a scale to make sure you can't send a dupe in that
Oh,
everybody
no
wears.
kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really
Whoa.
cool. That's really cool. That has to mean so much. I mean, and to
It
your
does.
dad. Yeah.
It does. But unfortunately, the job has changed so much now.
It's in what way?
Yeah.
It's just, they're under the microscope. I don't know. It's a tough job nowadays.
Is it because of social media and because of this, the overexposure of like, everyone hates cops now? Like that's what I feel like. I look online and it's so much hate against the blue, and it's so frustrating because I know you guys intimately, you know?
Well, just even like with the bail laws, people like let out of jail. I mean, they have no right to be walking on the street. The police officer was just killed. Police officer Dilla. Mm-hmm. He was killed 2 weeks ago. The guy that actually shot him was out on bail on a previous gun charge from last year for like $75,000 bail. But they have no bail now. So these guys, they just cut them loose. It's just...
Was it the governor who showed up?
Yeah, Governor Hochul actually came. Ex-President Trump actually came to the wake too. Wow. And Governor Hochul showed up the next day, I think, or maybe later on that night. But she was kindly asked to leave the service, and she wasn't invited in. But it was directly from the family. And
wow.
You know, you got to pick somebody to blame for all of this.
Of course.
I think the laws have just gotten so easier now. We had more of a control of it when we were cops. They surrendered the streets. They just gave them back.
You don't deal with this as much now that you're retired, but what if you had to live in that world where everything you did was so highly scrutinized? That would have made your job a hell of a lot harder, right?
I actually live in it. My son is on a job now. He has shield. He wears my protective shield.
So cool. Wow. So when you see him dealing with some of the things, especially the emotional side, talk to me about some of the things that you've seen the worst humanity has to offer. And I'm sure your son has the same.
It's true. We've seen some pretty evil things. And I hate to say it, just history repeats itself. It's like you read a story even tomorrow in the paper, you've read about it 20 years ago. But we worked some pretty horrendous cases. I had a young girl who had a baby. She actually put it in a bag and stuffed it down a sewer. The only reason we knew that she had a baby was she went to the hospital and she was only 15 years old.
Mm.
The doctors told us that she had carried a baby to full term. So they actually, we went there and interviewed her, and we sat with her for like 5 hours with her mother before she told us what she did with the discharge. When we found the baby, it probably had more hair on its head than I do now. And it was just terrible to see. And 2 years later, I was working another homicide in the same neighborhood. And then we went into McDonald's to get the video on the homicide that had occurred outside. And I walked in, and the young girl that we had previously arrested for that the baby incident, for killing a baby, she was serving hamburgers at McDonald's.
Freaking awful.
What?
Freaking awful.
Crazy. Just crazy stories.
And you went to that autopsy, didn't you?
Yeah.
What is that?
You know, it's just like watching a TV show where you see, you know, you really got to go to the autopsy because you have to testify at trial as to, you know, what you know and what transpired. So they did an autopsy on this poor little baby. And I was there with another detective. And there were other people who had passed away that were in the morgue there. But to see a child that small on a table. And on that particular day, one of my best friends that I coached my son's baseball team with, his daughter had a baby in the hospital. The next day, the baby had survived, and his daughter died that night. Internal bleeding. This was all on the same day. So we finally were able to locate that baby. And, you know, the girl was 15 at the time. There was no, I guess, laws on the books. So what do they do with a 15-year-old like this?
Yeah. Well,
It's right. Her parents didn't know that she was pregnant. She was a pretty big girl. And it was just, these were stories you never heard about. Like, where they were stories that we all carried. You know, you always think about it. Think about certain things. I got kids now, and there's too many horror stories out there.
And it has to be impossible not to take this stuff home with you. I mean, you can, you're hardened, you know, you've seen things, but that has to carry over into your personal life.
It's really almost like a switch that has to go off in your head, and you do carry it home. The case that you and I met over, Bruce Blackwood,
yeah.
That case, I took home with me every day. When I retired from the job, I took the caseload home because that's how much I wanted it solved. And not that it was going to help, but there were other guys that were working on it. And because of the efforts of all these other guys, along with myself, we were able to pull it off. And with your help, too.
Yeah, I didn't do anything. Katie, can you pull up a picture? I want to pull up a picture of young Steve. He's on the phone.
Yes.
So Steve, you had sent me this picture. I want to ask you, what is this? So around what time was this? What year, give or take?
This was like 1990, maybe.
Oh, no
we
kidding.
We had payphones and we had beepers, you know, no cell phones. But
so who was this guy? Who was 1990 Steve Phelan?
That's when I first became a detective. So I was still getting my feet wet and learning what to do. And one of them was not to get caught on the phone like that.
That's
great. Awesome. That's when I had hair on my head, too.
Yeah, right.
You have a lot of it.
I'm jealous. Yeah. Oh, man. So what is it like to talk to me about the brotherhood that exists in the NYPD and in the precincts? Like, is it something where your precinct is tight, or are you tight with every NYPD officer in the city? There's 75 precincts.
Every single one of them. You know what I mean? Anybody that has the guts and the balls to put on that gun and badge is my brother and sister. And yes, I would do anything for them. And it's the truth. Some poor yesterday, right by me, state trooper pulled the car over, and he was by himself. And it was on the news this morning, I think. Two good Samaritans happened to pull over because the guy tried to jump the cop, and they saved the cop. And you know what? It's like these stories nobody ever hears about. But
yeah,
we went back a long, long way with guys that I worked with years ago. In 1986, going into, 89, the crack wars, there were no narcotics units. It was just us in the street. And we were like the anti-crime unit. They weren't big units. They all formed after the unfortunate murder of Eddie Burns. That's when we took the streets back. But it took us a while.
Do you, Katie, we have that picture you sent us. If you pull it up, it should say Eddie Burns funeral.
This is actually in the exact spot where police officer Eddie Burns was murdered in 1989.
Wow.
And it's at the exact same time, at the exact same location. I went this year and I go with guys. One of my buddies has cancer. He got in the car and we drove in there. And there were hundreds of other guys who were there that night when that happened. And unfortunately, as I said, with the police officer Della, going back to Eddie Burns, 36 years later, same thing, history repeating itself. It's terrible. But I go every year.
Good for you. Why was it so important to do it at the site where he was killed?
We go to the 103 precinct, and police officer Eddie Burns' dad worked in narcotics, in warrants. And I actually met him on the job. So I knew him. I didn't know his son because the poor kid was only on the job for a month when that happened to him.
Oh.
It was heartbreaking. They executed him in a radio car. The 36-year anniversary, they actually just let one of these guys out of jail.
Did they really?
They let him out of jail.
Why?
This is what I want to know.
Yeah.
They paroled him. He got life. And now he's out. I think he was released 2 weeks ago. And then one of the guys who actually was shooting was a shooter. They denied him parole. They're all up for parole.
How is that even possible?
It's insane. Like, it's absolutely insane.
But what is it going to take to change? I mean, I don't see how it would ever change. Things are so screwed up.
It's crazy. Certain states, I can't really name all of them, but if you get life in prison, and I think Pennsylvania is one of them, life is life. You know, there is no parole.
That's it.
You get that sentence of life, you're going to jail for life. And unfortunately, there's certain people that sentence should be imposed by, you know.
I did a story in Texas one time about a guy who murdered two sisters back in the 80s. And by the time they caught him, they had to sentence him with the 1980 whatever guidelines. The guy got like 6 years for killing two people and was back on the streets in no time. It's so, this legal system is just so.
Some of the stories are horrendous, really. Those guys like that slipped through the cracks. But somebody dropped the ball somewhere. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's true. Now they're just opening the gates. But again, I'm not blaming other. I'm not a politician. But the last administration that just left City Hall is to blame. De Blasio turned those streets right back over. They just, they handcuffed the cops. They can't do this. They can't do that. Stop questioning Frisco's out. 99.9% of cops are good cops. They're definitely all bad ones, but there's more good than there are bad.
I believe that. And it pains me to see, like, I think just from working with so many of you guys, it's so hard to listen to just the hatred that exists because people are so quick to pull out their cell phone and record every traffic stop and put everybody under the microscope. And it's awful to see the bad rap that you all get. And
it's not to even put bumper stickers on your car and it's police related. Because they'll break a window on it. I mean, it's just insanity.
I don't think people understand what this world would be like without you guys. I mean, you are heroes, and your job is to keep the streets safe. And I don't think people realize what a world would look like without that. It's like that's what they want almost.
It's I don't know. That's a tough question to answer, but somebody's got to be there. There's certain people that do not deserve to walk on the face of this earth, never mind the streets of New York. And it's true. There are just evil people out there. That's the hardest part. There's cases that you try to forget, things that you'll see that you'll always remember. You know, there's too many horror stories. When looking for a little old man, he was missing. He actually had cancer. He was 90 years old. He went in the garage and he actually hung himself. So his wife was in the house. She was 89 years old. We found her husband, but we didn't tell her. And she had dementia. And eventually other family members had to explain to him. Walking out of that place, I was heartbroken. I really was. This poor little old man, 90 years old, worked all his life, had cancer. And then these are the way, those are pictures that in your mind you won't forget. And But you know what? It also inspires you. You're doing God's work. You know, I'm not worried about anybody else. I'm doing what I think is right. And that's the same thing every other cop thinks, I think.
How do you compartmentalize that stuff? Like you see these bad things, but something has to push them into a deep, dark corner so that you can continue to do your job. Is that fair?
No, but sometimes you get caught up with certain cases, but they mean a lot to you because of the work and the effort that not only you and probably a bunch of other guys or girls did the work on to try to get to the end, and especially the Blackwood case. It took us 10 years to get him, and it wasn't me. It was a lot of guys involved. Detective Stratford, Detective Laspina, Detective DeLuca, Detective Galasso, Detective Lobel. I mean, we worked this case for over 10 years, and it wasn't solved till almost 5 years after I retired.
Wow. And
that case was the only case I actually made a copy of and took home with me. And it was like as thick as the Bible almost. I don't know if that's politically correct.
No, it absolutely is. So let's talk about it.
But it was crazy because of all the effort that we had put into that. And the things that that man had said to us and laughed at us. And he said, "You'll never get me for the murder."
That's what I when I was talking about the case last week, I told these girls, I said, I said, he said something that will make your skin crawl, but I want Steve to tell it. So let's back up a second before we get to that. So
yeah, no worries.
No. Talking about the Blackwood case. So that's actually the reason you and I met. We just kind of by chance, but we met over Zoom. Like this.
Yeah, we did.
This was like, we did this during the height of COVID, which I couldn't believe we didn't lose any steam during COVID. So
wait a second. You made me go out in the cold.
I'm in Brooklyn
in the snow with the whole crew. And where's he? He's in the crib with the sides up.
You saw me from here up, man. I didn't even have pants on.
Be careful with that. He got jammed up over that. I forget his name.
I want to talk about So I want to back up just a couple steps here, because how do you, some of these stories you just told me and some of the horror stories you relived, how do you translate that? Blackwood occupied, like you said, 5-6 years of your life. How do you then put that behind you and shift gears to becoming, when a production company calls you out of the blue, like the second the cases are over or they see it on another show, they reach out to you and they're like, "Do you want to do this again?" So how do you pick and choose which projects you agree to do?
Well, the only reason why me and you were doing this is because of what you did with the last show. And I really liked it. And I thought we really told pretty much everything, the true story, from beginning to end. I mean, without going into certain details like you just said, the words he mentioned to me and how we had got along with each other. I spent a lot of time in an interview room with that guy. And that guy looking across the table was just pure evil.
Ugh.
Looking through his eyes was just, I'm sure you saw his past history.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if you ladies are aware of it, but he had kidnapped his baby, his ex-girlfriend, and he left his ex-mother-in-law at an apartment, tied her up, and set the place on fire. But the mass troopers actually caught up with him, and he actually stabbed one of the troopers. But they didn't shoot him because he had the baby in his hand.
And we were just talking about this, like how people get out of jail who shouldn't be out. I mean, that's attempted murder how many times? And he was still, I know he was in jail for a while, but
that wasn't his first rodeo.
No,
we all believe that he was responsible for more.
Yes.
Crimes against females. There's no doubt in my mind. He was good at what he did. And
do you think he killed before?
I can't say that, but it was discussed. And it wouldn't put it past him. It really wouldn't. He just was pure evil. But
he just seemed so quick to kill Bruce over something so stupid.
Well, and even when he talked about it, Ed, because you were saying, you know, when he was trying to get Martin involved and it escalated from, "We'll rough him up a little bit and then we'll kill him." Like what a wild jump.
You know what it was? That was his livelihood that was being cut off. He had worked with Ed Blackwood, Bruce, for a long time. I don't know how many years it was, but it was a while. And the bottom line was, he had no place to go. There was no other project that Mr. Blackwood was working on. There was another apartment that he was working on, but it was nowhere near for anyone to move into. Mm-hmm. So Perez was actually going to be forced out of that Hancock Street address very shortly because all the apartments were all done. And Perez had done the whole upstairs, including the apartment he was in. I mean, I covered every inch of that place, but he had drilled holes in the floor so he could see one of the girls that he rented the bottom apartment to.
Oh,
was that Irene?
And we moved his bed out and we found him.
That's sick.
It was crazy. I'm telling you. And that was his ex-girlfriend that he got into the apartment.
Mm-hmm.
She came from a homeless shelter right around the corner.
Aww.
But the original hope for that building was, by Mr. Blackwood, was to help out people in need. It was a 7-8 house, but it was redone from top to bottom. And that he was kind of giving back to the community. Those buildings are worth some big bucks now. That's a brownstone. And it just, the whole thing just turned into a nightmare. This guy, Blackwood, had worked all his life, 40 years with American Airlines. He did not miss one day of work when he worked there. He left there, then he went to the other bar, O'Neill's, picture you had just put up, and he was the manager. Never missed a day there either. That particular day, he called in sick. We actually had the tape recording of it because he called in, said he was home and fell in a shower. When actuality, he was being murdered by Perez from the Hancock Street address. We were able to pinpoint that the cell site and everything involved in it. It was just horrendous. But that's what happened, you know. But I put a lot into it, me and his brother, Ed.
That's what I was going to ask you. I wanted to transition to that. So talk to me about your relationship with Ed Blackwood, because I have a relationship with him. You had a relationship with him. And we all, I think, saw glimpses of the same person. I mean, this guy who could be, he was dealing with some health problems, but he was prickly is the way I describe him. But at the root of him, he was just passionate, I think. And he was a well-respected guy who cared deeply about finding answers about his brother. So talk to me about your relationship with Ed.
I met Ed early on in the investigation, probably the first week that he came into the precinct. The case was originally assigned to two detectives, Ospina and DeLuca. But as soon as we started investigating, we knew something was terribly wrong with the information that was given to us by Ed. And we worked really hard on it, all of us. I jumped in. Half the guys in the office did, but we could never pinpoint. I mean, we pinpointed where we believed the homicide happened, but it took us a lot to get to that point because we never found his body. And taking a case like that to Brooklyn is insane. So now Ed used to call, I swear, at least once or twice a week. And I didn't blame him. I have brothers and I felt the same way he did. His brother, Bruce, didn't as much as receive a parking summons, and he disappeared off the face of the earth. So we knew something was terribly wrong. Ed pursued it. I worked the case for 4 years, maybe 5 years. Well, my last 5 years on a job. We put the two guys in jail, but not for the homicide, for the robbery of Mr. Blackwood. And that's a long story to that.
We dove in. So I did a real about an hour and a half dive into that case and just the details of it. So our listeners know kind of the broad strokes of it, which is going to tie this interview in nicely. But what made you so passionate about finding answers, Fred? I mean, was it the nature of the case, or was it just, it's what you do?
Just from the second it kicked off, the surroundings of it. His brother, who worked so hard all his life, just disappear and not talk to one of his brothers that he had spoken to every day. And he had a couple of friends that he spoke to every single day. Two girls, they were like his sisters. And when they knew something was wrong, they called right away too. And I believe within 24 hours that we had caught the case and we were seriously investigating it. But unfortunately, we were too late.
Well, and the kind of theme we're doing, the way we're doing this show, we're doing it in themes, and we're doing a whole theme right now about no body cases. And so I want you to tell me from a detective standpoint, what is so challenging about investigating a case where you don't have a body? So to me, it seems like that no physical evidence at that point, that you're relying strictly on circumstantial, unless you find something in that apartment, but you didn't have that either. So talk to me about the challenges when you don't have Bruce's body.
Well, even though Bruce Blackwood owned that building, Perez lived there and he had the third floor. So we would need consent for him to let us go through that apartment. We didn't want consent from him. We wanted to search that whole building from top to bottom. So for the first 6 months of the investigation, we had to tie every link we possibly could. The best was when we were able to use the bank because they had reimbursed Mr. Blackwood prior to him, his passing. The day before, he was reimbursed to $7,700.
Wow.
But instead of him going to the precinct and reporting the grand larceny, and we were like less than a mile and a half away, he went to Brooklyn and confronted the perps. And in the spur of the moment, they did what they did. So he was actually missing for like 48 hours before we could concretely say that something severely went wrong with this. But
have you ever worked another case where that was the kind of this high profile where there was no body? Or was this your only one?
This probably was one of the biggest cases that I worked on, and probably the first one and almost only one I've worked on that we didn't have a body. And it wasn't for a lack of effort. What we did was, in the first 6 months, we were able to build that case using the bank, and we were able to tie search warrants from the Brooklyn Supreme Court on that apartment that Perez was in. And we simultaneously pulled everything off at the same time. We got a cadaver dog with us. We had people from all over, crime scene, and we took everything out of that house, including the brand new pipes that Perez had put into the house because he had used sulfuric acid or brand new pipes.
Wow.
And that's like unheard of. And we were able to tie this all together prior to getting the search warrant. So it took us, for the time that we knew that something went terribly wrong in there, for us to get legal access to hit that apartment and then build the case from there. And then again, it took almost eight years after that. Mm-hmm. But somebody was constantly trying to do something with that case.
Did you have a point in the investigation where it was kind of accepted that you probably wouldn't recover a body and you were just on a mission to find out what happened? Or was there always people holding out hope that the body would be discovered?
I really didn't believe that he could have disposed of their body in the fashion that he did. Mm-hmm. I mean, he chopped his body into pieces using a sawzall in a bathtub, a brand new bathtub he just put in, his bathtub. Yeah. And he collected every piece. We found some blood there, but nothing we could conclusively tie to Bruce Blackwood. Perez lived in the apartment, so we definitely found DNA from him. But as I said, it was a real tough case. It was one of the toughest cases I ever worked. And what happened was I retired, and the two guys who originally had the case were still working. They probably had another 5 years to go to. So they stayed on the case. And what they did was they tried to generate information, but their problem was the homicide really happened in Brooklyn, but we were in Queens.
Brooklyn
says, listen, we'll take that homicide, but you got to show us exactly where it happened. And because the case was still being built by us, we couldn't. We were the only ones who had worked on it until Stratford got involved from Cold Case and a couple other people in his office. But they did a phenomenal job with that case. They really did. But after I retired, Ed Blackwood would call those two detectives, Sweaty Joe and Steve DeLuca.
Stop a second. I told them about Sweaty Joe.
Yeah. I didn't give him a nickname. He earned it, you know, when we were on patrol. But anyway.
Sweaty guy.
At any time they gave him a case, he started to sweat. But this guy was one of the best detectives I ever worked for. And he was a little overwhelmed by that. But,
sure.
So I retire.
Yeah.
And Ed Blackwood is now calling Laspina and Joe at least twice a week. So Joe Laspina decides, Sweaty Joe gives him my cell phone number and says that, yeah, he's going to be doing PI work. you know, he knows this case better than anybody else. Why don't you call him? So Ed called me. I think he called me 2 days later. And I actually worked on that case. And my father actually worked on that case too with me. My
father,
I didn't know that.
Over 20 something years. Wow. And he and I both went up to Harlem where Ed had lived on 101st Street and like 2nd Avenue. And he had lived up there all his life.
Wow.
He had worked, I think he was a PA for 40 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And the guy was just a gentleman. From that day, me and him communicated probably weekly. Where I would close my eyes at night and actually have nightmares about certain cases, or that he was calling me. But me and him made a deal. And we said, listen, we're going to see this happen. Because we knew who did the homicide. It just was, we needed that straw to break the camel's back.
Mm-hmm. And you got it in the form of it. There was a piece of it you got when you got him for the forgery. At least that put him away for a little bit. So tell me about busting them for that. And then now, what did he say to you when you got him?
We had finally arrested him, as I said, at 6 months in. So we had them both indicted in the grand jury for grand larceny, for stealing $7,700 from the bank, which was now the victim. So we had a victim to put on the stand, because if it was Bruce, we wouldn't have had a complainant. We would have been out of luck. So fortunately for us, we tried to do an agreement with him. It's called the proffer, where you actually pull him out of jail and see if one of them wants to cooperate or give us information that could help their case. So we all showed up for the proffer agreement. Both defendants, me and another detective, and they turned it down. Each one of them took a plea. So Colasso and Laspina did attempt to elicit information from the correctional facilities that they had been assigned to. But again, it was tedious work, and it took a group effort to, and we found it in another way by going through his family. It was insane.
But what did he say to you about, you're going to get me for the check? You're not getting me for murder, right?
All right. So we were walking in the profit. He was going in to testify on his behalf, saying that he had not stolen the money, that he was entitled to it for the work that he had completed. So we standing outside the grand jury. And he looked at me and he laughed in my face and he said to me and another detective who was standing there, he says, you're never going to get me for this murder and I'm going to walk on this grand larceny.
Oh.
And he just knew the system so well. And he had come in contact with the law many a times. So,
yeah, no stranger.
When you hear something like that, does that energize you in a vindictive way, like bring it on. I'm gonna nail you.
I wasn't vindictive, but I knew that he was the guy who had killed this poor man. And I made a deal with his brother that I would solve that case. Or I would take it to the grave with me. And I said, if you're going before me and Perez is still here, we're both gonna go take care of him together. I said, I have a special place where we can put him.
It's gotta motivate you when to something like that. It's just like a, I don't know. It's extra fuel on the fire. Like we need to get this evil bastard.
It's unimaginable that he would walk on the streets for 10 years after killing somebody and dismembering him. Mm-hmm. And supposedly distributing his body all over. I don't believe that's true.
You were saying, yeah.
I kind of believe that he could probably lead us possibly to that body, because what would he have done with it in 48 hours? There was one container across the street. You know, you saw where it was located.
Mm-hmm.
It was just one commercial building there, but right behind there were the railroad tracks, and he had to live there all his life.
But what do you make about his story that he put him in bags and had homeless people kind of disperse them throughout the city?
I don't know. I don't think he would have done that. I think he dispersed them himself. And I believe he had Martinez help him.
Rodriguez.
Price was pretty stupid about a lot of things, right? Like, went into the bank, forged the checks with his own like, he did a lot of things that were really dumb. Would somebody who did that then proceed to think through, like, A, he doesn't have a lot of money, it doesn't sound like, to pay these homeless people, but would he think to, okay, I'll have several different people take different parts? Like, that seems really well thought out for somebody who thus far had been pretty dumb.
He had a second plan for that. His plan was, there was a rental agent gentleman. He was a liaison for Section 8 and for girls that were staying at that motel that was around the corner. And I believe that this guy was getting fringe benefits for helping them out, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of communication between Perez and this agent for the 48 hours after Ed went missing.
Interesting.
And I firmly believe that the rental agent could possibly have a hand in it because Perez had suggested to him that Ed Blackwood wasn't going to be back for a while and that he wanted the money and the checks from Section 8 to be sent to him because he was going to be the property manager now. So he wasn't as dumb as he looked. He really wasn't. Hmm. Once he got into it, he tried to think of a way out of it. But we really felt this guy was involved in it until he told us the story that no, he wanted him to change and the guy refused to do it. He would not change Section 8 to put it in Perez's name without talking to Mr. Black.
Wow. Well, and one of the ways that you guys eventually nailed him was you mentioned it was like through family and stuff, but it was this newspaper article that ran, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Tell me about that. So this, first of all, this reporter was a badass. This Allison. And so tell me the story about this article that runs. How does it come about?
What had happened was Ed contacted me and he said, listen, we've called the FBI. We had cold case. We made contact with a lot of units to see if we could get some fresh eyes and to revitalize this case. So he had reached out to a couple of different agencies and he had called the Daily News and he spoke to that female reporter. I know I couldn't say her last, I don't know her last name.
I can't remember. It was Allison something. I can't remember her last name.
But that girl broke this case wide open. I told her not to go near Perez by herself because Perez was out running around.
Jeez.
So he got out of jail. So she actually confronted him herself and told him to do a report on this. She tracked down the neighborhood, the locations where he was. I told her not to go near him because of how dangerous he was.
Yeah.
But eventually what he did was, he had a daughter that lived in a housing project there, and he never took care of her pretty much her whole life. Mm. But when she was 18, he tried to befriend her, and she had read this newspaper article. Allison had put it in the Daily News. It was like 2 or 3 pages in the New York Daily News. And you know how big that is. It was almost like the Justice story.
Right.
Wow.
And she had pictures in it, and I had responded, you know, I gave her comments on it. I wouldn't let her use pictures of me, but his daughter decided on herself that it would be the right thing to do, to cooperate. Mm-hmm. And she actually got him on tape.
Wow.
We listened to some of those clips, and it is just, it's some of the most disturbing stuff, and I'm sure that you've heard too. I mean, the way he describes it, it's like it's like he's talking about some kind of animal carcass.
Were you able to translate the Spanish conversation?
I had the raw tape somewhere back when we did the show, and I don't have it anymore. It was 3 hours.
That was the greatest thing. That's what sunk him a trial. He was talking to his daughter in Spanish and telling her how to testify and say that the police planted all of this information into you and they're going to arrest you and they're going to do this to you. So sure enough, she took the stand, she testified against him. And then she said that he put her up to that. But we had it all recorded. He figured because he spoke Spanish, we wouldn't know how to translate it.
Yeah. And Irene, she when we talked to, speaking of badasses, Melissa Carvajal, the prosecutor, she this was awesome, but she had told me how difficult Irene became after those conversations. So Perez was contacting her, telling her what to do. He knew he was sunk. So he was telling her how to act, how to testify. And then she got real squirrely. So as on board as she was to record him, once it came time to testify, then she got, it was tough, but she did.
Oh yeah, she really did. And I'll tell you what, I walked out of that courtroom and I never I met her prior to after she testified, she walked out and she looked at me and she said, "You're the detective that was in that article that I read." And that article that she had read gave her enough nerve to record her father.
Wow.
And then she turned the tape over to the 7-5 precinct. And then Detective Stratford picked the case up from there. And we had new life to it. And these guys ran with it until we all testified at it. I testified a couple of days, and I knew the Blackwood family, and I considered that man a friend of mine.
And did you ever, when you were prepping, did you ever worry that this was Melissa Carvajal's first nobody case that she was prosecuting as well? Did you worry that there wouldn't be enough, even though you had these words, like what if it's him running his mouth? You still didn't have a body. You still didn't have any hard evidence.
In Brooklyn, New York, he could have 10 bodies and he's still going to have a tough time to prove a homicide case. If you're from Brooklyn, you know what I mean. But it's the truth. But we all knew we were rolling the dice going in there. But that girl was probably one of the best prosecutors that could have handled that case. And she did an amazing job. She really did.
Absolutely. What would you give to get the real story from Luis Perez? Like, even now, let's say tomorrow you pick up the phone and he's willing to talk. Like, what would that mean to you?
I would actually speak to him. I really would. Because I spent hours with him prior to him being arrested and charged with the crimes that we charged him with. I wasn't there when Detective Stratford was able to arrest him on the murders. But we were there. I testified in court for a few days. But we were there every day for the verdict and the sentencing. And, you know, it was just a part of you. I really looked at Ed like he was close to me. You know, I called him on his birthday. I'd break his shoes over this. But we had a good relationship. You know what I mean?
And the one thing I didn't get to talk about in the last episode, just because we were running long, and if you ladies have that, the text message. So last year, was it last year? It was 2020. Yeah, I think it was last year. I got a random text message and we have a picture of it somewhere. It should just say text message. I want to put it up because it was strange. I didn't know where it came from. It was a random.
Wasn't it an Instagram message?
No, it was like, I got a text and I was like blown away how my number even came up. But basically it was just a picture of a memorial service card. There was no message. There was no, I didn't recognize the number. And I'm like, what? Yeah, here it is.
Right.
So this is all I got. Funeral arranged for Edward S. Blackwood. And I was blown away because this was 2 years after we filmed the case. I thought I was done with being involved. Yeah. And then out of nowhere, I get a message that Ed had passed away. And it was just very sad. And the first thing I did was reach out to you.
Well, that message actually got put up by his.
There he is. Have you seen this, Steve? Oh, yeah.
Niece.
So it was his niece.
His oldest brother's daughter, Desiree. And that was her way to try to reach out to us because she didn't have a number for you guys or any of the detectives that were involved in the case, because he talked pretty highly of certain guys didn't work the case.
Yeah, right. Not all of them.
Yeah.
But what did that, when I told you that, how did that, what did you think? I mean, that was sad. I was sad to hear that.
I knew
he was sick, but.
Yeah, it broke my heart. I actually called up there immediately. And Desiree, I don't think I spoke to her that day, but we were able to contact, I think, the funeral home, and they were able to verify that he had passed away. And I just felt really bad. And I've spoken to her since then. I think I spoke to her last week. And she's in good spirits. She actually lives in the same subletted apartment that her uncle had for 40 years.
Wow.
Wow.
That was a nice place. We felt in his place.
Overlooking the East River.
Absolutely. It was a beautiful place.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
But anyway, she's a nice girl. And I think she said that her uncle talked pretty highly with a few detectives that were involved in the case. But he had no good words for a couple other guys I know.
Did it close a chapter for you to... It's sad, but it also was like the end of the story almost.
I watched him tell me his brother was missing. And then we were finally able to tell him we got the guy.
Wow.
And then I was there for his, they let him say something to Perez prior to the judge sentencing him. And it broke my heart, but I had to stand there with him. But, I didn't have to, but he got to say his piece. And then he moved on past that. We kind of closed the chapter that needed to be closed in his life. And you know what? It needed to be closed for a lot of guys because we all just knew what the outcome would be. But were we ever going to find out? You know?
And I think it sucks that he never got to find his brother. He never had that tangible piece of something to bury or something to a place to go to grieve. Like you do. That's the part about not having a body that always gets me. It's not so much for the investigation's sake, but for the family as well. You don't have that loved one.
And Desiree's dad had passed away a little while after the end of the trial.
Mm.
You know, and I had met him there because he had gone to the trial almost every day with Ed. And you don't know where Ed was. Some days he was a friendly guy. Some days he was not.
That's a fact. But he was, depending on what passionate.
Depending on what side you were on.
It's true.
Right?
It's true.
That was a gentleman. And
he really was. He was smooth, too. He showed up for his interview wearing a leather coat. I was like, damn, boy. He was smooth. He was a good-looking guy.
Very, very dapper, very handsome.
Dapper is the word. That's a great word.
That's it.
So how do you shift gears then to, this is just a kind of a quick mention because we're not going to go too long, but I want to find out what it's like to have to, you live these cases. And then when a production company calls you to do a television show about it, how do you prepare for something like that? I imagine you prep like it's like you're going to testify because you want to make sure your dates are right and your facts are right. So it's got to be, there's got to be a lot going on in your head to present these then, all this work you did in 5 years to present it in a 2-3 hour interview.
Well, you know what? Certain things get burned in your mind. I could tell you, it almost feels like it was yesterday when the case started. But there's things that you will remember and there's things you really have to remember and you want to put them into the right perspective.
Hmm.
Can I tell you what I remember? So do you guys have the picture of Steve's mustache?
Oh, the guy put my mustache on sideways.
Jesus Christ.
Does it look better today?
It looks so good.
I love that.
You know who sent me that? My ex-partner, Mark.
No kidding. Just for some clarity, this was Steve. This wasn't Cold Case Files. This was another production that had done an interview with Steve before, covered the Blackwood case, but this was a show that did recreations as well. So they obviously cast Detective Peelin, and here was the actor.
They told me it was going to be De Niro.
It was Kevin De Niro though. So, oh my God, Steve. Well, this is cool. And I can't, I can't thank you enough for joining us and just kind of walking us through this. And I love you, brother. I mean, you are doing God's work, even in retirement. You miss the hunt, don't you?
Yeah, you know what you do? You miss doing certain things. I get to relive it to my son, but don't tell him I said that.
I won't.
We'll cut that out.
Yeah. What's life like now? Grandkids just hanging out?
Yeah. I go to my daughter's house. She's a nurse. My son-in-law is a fireman, city fireman.
Wow.
My son,
your whole family serves.
Yeah, my son's a detective. He's actually a U.S. Marshal. And
my goodness.
And his wife is a nurse practitioner. So who do you think babysits my four grandsons that are all under five?
Pappy Peeling.
They got two apiece. I'm telling you.
Wow.
Got it in South Jamaica.
What's harder, investigating murder cases or watching all these grandkids?
You know what? You miss going after guys that need to be put in jail. And
yeah,
there's not enough cops to collect them all. And then when they do collect them, that's a whole nother story.
But there's got to be something to your career's over. And now you get to lay in a warm bed and snuggle your grandkids. I mean, you did it. You made it out alive. And now you get to enjoy just being, you know.
It's true. You know, everybody carries a cross with them. Some crosses are different. Look, I got a Ranger cross on, right? But New York Rangers.
We don't talk about it. They're in the playoffs.
Yeah.
They beat the Flyers.
You know, you carry a couple crosses with you. You just got to learn to deal with them. That's all. And there's no other way around it. You don't forget about them. It is what it is. And it's unfortunate. There are other cops I know that, you know, they couldn't get through that mental anguish. You know what I mean?
Sure. So, well, you're a good man, Steve. And I thank you for taking part in this. And it's always a pleasure.
Talk anytime. Nice meeting you, ladies.
Thank you so much.
All right. We'll talk.
We're going to get good at this.
I know. Yes. We got so much more to talk about that's not Blackwood related. So we'll talk.
You got
so much.
TBD. All right. Take care.
Nice meeting you.
Bye. Thank
you. Thanks for listening to another episode of Murder Unscripted. If you like us, and we hope that you do, don't forget to like and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform. Check us out on Facebook, TikTok, Insta at Murder Unscripted. Shoot us an email, murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or shout out on our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.